So, all right. Hi, my name is Olivia Friedman, and I'm lucky enough to teach at Ida Crown, and I'm very happy to be here. So we are going to talk today about what Wonder Woman can teach you about Judaism. So this is going to make the most sense to people who have seen the film, but if you haven't seen it, I'm going to lead with a synopsis, which I apologize in advance will ruin it for you. So I am ruining the movie. So if anyone wants to leave right now so there are no spoilers, you got your shot. But this is what it is. Pretty much, Wonder Woman has been a blockbuster success. You've probably seen lots of news articles about it, and people are very into it, and they're like, this is a great role model for women, and lots of discussion. And obviously, we as Jews have our own pride in it, because Gal is the star, and she's Israeli, and it's very nice to have a situation where you get positive press for Israel, where people are happy and excited about someone who's Israeli. So all those things, you've probably heard the whispers on the air. So now what I'm going to talk to you about is, what is this story? What's going on in the storyline? Pretty much, there is this island, and the island is called Themyscira, and it is completely run by women. It's just women on this island, and these women are not just any women, they're Amazons. So they're fierce warriors and warrioresses, whatever the plural of that would be. And so on this island, you have a queen, you have the queen's daughter, the princess, her name is Diana. And what they've been told is that the reason for their existence, why they are there, is because there is the god of war named Ares, who has not been completely vanquished, and one day Ares is going to come back into the world and cause chaos and problems, and so these women who are training so hard on this island will then have a mission to go and kill the god of war, and that will bring peace back into the world. So everyone has to train really hard for that purpose. So they're all training on the island, and they're living their nice existence, and they were also told that they were given a gift by Zeus, and this gift is this weapon called the God Killer, and that's what they're going to use in order to defeat and kill Ares. So everything is very nice and very tranquil and peaceful and happy on the island, but one day this pilot named Steve crash lands on the island, and after him comes a whole bunch of Germans, and the Germans are the enemy in this story. It's not World War II, so it's not exactly a Nazi situation. Right, but there's similarities going on. So all the Germans are chasing him. There's Steve Trevor, who's trying to, you know, live. And then along come all these women, and the women are like, okay, we have to fight for the good guys. So these women show off all their impressive fighting skills. They save Steve, and then they interrogate him. You know, who are you? Why are you here? He says, how could you not know that there's this incredible world war that everybody is embroiled in? I don't know. I don't know how you haven't heard of this, but I got to go back to the war. I'm a spy. I have a very important job. There's this horrible woman named Dr. Poison. She's come up with this terrible way to gas lots of people. This sounds familiar, right? So she has come up with this terrible way to gas a lot of people. We need to stop her. And I need to go find her recipe for this gas, and I need to make sure that I can take it back and give it to the Allies, and we can go against her. So that's his whole plan. Long story short, Diana decides to join him on this quest. And when she goes off the island into the real world, which is London, she suddenly discovers that, first of all, women are not treated the same way that they were on the island. So she has to get used to the differences in, you know, people looking at her as someone who should be wearing a dress and should be doing lots of more stereotypical things and not someone who's a warrior or going to go into battle. And also she's very concerned by what seems to be the callousness of people, because she's very nurturing and benevolent, and her main concern is, we have to save everybody and we have to like take care of people, because we should take care of people. And she also has this deep in-rooted belief that if she kills Ares, all the bad things will stop, that everything is because of Ares as god of war. And so her journey over the course of the film is her learning about the fact that people are not perfect, and that people have good and evil within them, as we are all familiar from our own tradition with the idea of a Yetzer Hara and a Yetzer Tov, and that despite that, even though just killing the god of war will not be sufficient to eradicate everything, people might still be worth saving. And along the way, there's a little bit of romance and all these nice things that they throw in. So that is the story of Wonder Woman. It's the story of her origins, like where she came from and how she comes into the world and how she shows off her power and saves the world during this horrible war. So how I've structured this shiur is, I've taken little excerpts or scenes from the film. And for each scene, what we're going to look at is either a parallel within our Jewish tradition, or if not an exact parallel, maybe how does our Jewish tradition deal with this concept? Is it similar? Do we end up coming to the same conclusions? Do we come to different conclusions? How does it work? So the very first scene has to do with the question of what are men actually necessary for? So we're starting there. All right. When Wonder Woman meets up with Steve, there's this funny moment. The two of them are in a boat. They're on their way to London. And she says to Steve, the conclusion of one of the women philosophers she read while she was on the island of Themyscira was that men were necessary for reproduction, but not for much else. And now the question is that a Jewish concept? And surprisingly, I'm going to say somewhat, and I'm focusing here specifically on the idea of necessary, and we're going to go into depth about what exactly do I mean. So in order to go into depth, we're going to start with some psukim. So I figured it might be more fun if this was interactive. If I have any volunteers who would like to read in either Hebrew or English source number 2, I will offer that up. Do I have takers for that? Do you want to, do any readers? Okay, great. You read number 2.
Elisha Amar Harba Arved Nitzvah. I can't read the Hebrew anymore. Nitzvah.
Itzvonech.
Baharonech. Be'etzev tel di banim be'elisheich.
Excellent. Okay, and so here this is the scene with Adam and Chava, which may be familiar to everybody, where the two of them are in the garden and they've just disobeyed God, and Hashem is telling them the punishments, and one of the punishments for the woman is this idea that she's going to have pain in childbirth, her desire will be for her husband, he will rule over her. Then we have an echo of this language, which comes up in with Cain and Hevel, and we're going to see that in source number 3. Anybody here want to read source number 3?
Sure.
Go ahead.
You do write. Oh, go ahead.
Halal in Tetiv?
Yes.
Halal in Tetiv, Se'et, Imbo Tetiv, Petachata, Robes, Ve'lachat, Shukrato, Atat, and Shalbo.
Okay, perfect. So Hashem is giving a pep talk to Cain in this story. Cain and Hevel were two brothers. They were the sons of Adam who fought with one another. And it ends to a tragedy. It ends to the very first murder in the world. But at this point, what's happening is that Cain's offering to God has not been accepted. He is sad about that, that his offering wasn't accepted by God. And God says to him, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you can rule over it. So if you compare those two psukim, you're going to notice that there's a similar concept. Anyone want to tell me what you notice? What's coming through in terms of our echoes and echoed language?
Desire.
Right, the desire. We have this idea that there's a desire of the woman to the man, and there's a desire of sin or the Yetzer Hara for Cain, which sounds a little bit off-putting at first, because it sounds like you're putting the woman into the category of the Yetzer Hara. You're like, whoa, what's going on with that? How could that be? And what's interesting is if you look at the Hebrew, the specific word that's being used there, teshukah, is a unique word. Usually, if you hear a word about desire, you might think of a word like ritzon, you know, the will or something like that. So teshukah only shows up in a couple of different contexts, and there's a meaning behind it. And so that's going to get us to number 4. So we've got the beast that crouches at the door. This is a book by Rabbi David Foreman, who I recommend. He has a lot of good and interesting books. And he also has a website, Aleph Beta. Some of you may be familiar with that. So he talks about this idea of teshukot, these 4 primal desires. So we're going to read some, and I'll summarize some, but we can start off with the reading, with over 1,000 years ago. Any readers? Go ahead.
Over 1,000 years ago, the rabbis of the Midrash noticed the analogy we have been wrestling with. They had something quite intriguing to say about it. They observed that the Bible uses the Hebrew term teshukah, desire, in both verses we have been discussing. In tracing the various scriptural occurrences of this word, the sages recognized a pattern. Here's what they had to say. There are 4 basic teshukot in the world, the teshukah of Eve for Adam, the teshukah of the evil inclination for Cain, the teshukah of rain for land, and the teshukah of the master of the universe for humanity. The sages cite additional verses, which I have not reproduced here, to substantiate each one of these conclusions. But let's focus on just these 4 statements. What are the rabbis really saying? It seems to me that they are defining the word teshukah and making a sweeping, almost radical statement in the process. Look carefully at the 4 examples they give. The desire of Eve for Adam, the evil inclination for Cain, of rain for land, and of God for humanity, and see if you can isolate a common denominator among them.
Pause for 1 second, because I want you to actually think about it for a minute and before he gives away his answer, and see if you see any similarities between it. You know, what is the similarity between teshukah of Chava for Adam, evil inclination for Cain, reign for the land, and master of the universe for humanity? If you don't notice it, no problem. But just I want you to think about it first. If I have anyone who wants to throw out ideas, go ahead.
It almost seems like the other one needs the first. Like humanity needs God. Adam needs Eve. I don't know how it's, but kind of needs in some way, I guess, the creator.
Good. Perfect. Okay, so what's your name?
Bluma.
All right, I'm glad we got Bluma. I planted her there so she would tell us the answers. But perfect. It's reversed, right? If you're looking at it, you would think it makes more sense to say the land needs rain or that humanity needs God. But here it seems reversed, where it's that's exactly like you said. It's the opposite. There's a flipped effect, and we have to figure out why is that and where is that stemming from. So well done, Bluma. You can continue reading. Thank you. What's your name?
Renee.
Thank you, Renee.
While you were mulling that over, you might notice that some of the desires indicated by the rabbis don't sound much like desires at all. Let's look, for example, at the last two, the desire of rain for land and the desire of the Almighty for humanity. If you were given the words rain and land and someone asked you which of these two desires the other, what would you say? I would say land is the one with the desire. Land needs rain to nourish its crops. Rain doesn't need land at all. And the same holds for God and humanity. A basic tenet of theology states that God is a perfect being who has no needs at all. So if we're contemplating God and humans, if anything, it should be humanity that desires God. Why did the sages have it the other way around?
Okay, so we're going to pause here for a new reader, for when desire is divorced from need. Who else likes to read here? Or will read? Go ahead. Okay.
I would argue that the sages define teshukah as something entirely different from what we usually think of when we use the word desire. When you and I normally talk about desire, we associate desire with need. Think about the synonyms we use for desire. When we desire a new car, we say, I need a new car, or I want a new car. Both need and want are connected to the idea of lack. When I'm wanting or needful, I am missing something. When I get it, that hole in my life is filled and my want or need is satisfied. Usually when we talk about desire, we are really talking about getting needs fulfilled. The question you should contemplate is this: is that the only kind of desire there is in this world? Or perhaps is desire a larger concept than this? Is there a desire that is not based on the sense of need, that doesn't come from some kind of lack I have? If all my needs and wants were taken care of, would that be it? Or could I still have some sense of desire? I think the sages are answering that question with a resounding yes. Yes, it is possible to desire something even when you don't need anything. Rain doesn't need land, a wit, whatever wit is, but something it still desires is land. God doesn't need people, a wit, either, but somehow he still desires them. The sages are arguing, I think, that teshukah is the code name for this special kind of desire. And it is very kind of desire, this teshukah, that the feminine has for the masculine, and that the evil inclination, whatever that is, has for Cain. So what exactly is the essential nature of teshukah? How are we to understand a desire that is divorced from need?
Okay, so before we look at his answer, I'm curious for yours, right? Usually, as he's pointed out, when we say, I desire something, it comes from a place of, we don't have it yet, and we want it, right? I would love to have that brand new car, or that beautiful house, or whatever it may be. I don't have it, I want it. What does it mean to want something, or to desire something, that doesn't come from a lack within? What would that potentially look like? Anyone have theories or ideas? And if you don't, that's totally fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Let's say, I desire a new necklace because it'll enhance. Like, I'm not, lacking. I may have enough, but I still want more to enhance
what I already have.
Yeah.
Okay, beautiful. So maybe it's an add-on. It's like, you know, it's not this deep desire of, oh, I must have it, and I covet it, and I feel so sad without it. It's just, I have many things, and I would also enjoy this additional one. Other ideas? Where else? What else would it look like to have a desire that isn't from lack? Yeah.
Sounds to me like you're describing more of a magnetic attraction kind of thing. Can it maybe link to the desire to give?
Desire to give? Okay. So in that, right, if you're giving to someone else, then that's not that I lack and I want for myself. It's that I want to give to others, potentially, could be a way to look at it. Yeah?
Maybe to fulfill your purpose. So, like, as human beings, in order to fulfill our purpose, we need God.
Mm-hmm.
So in God's desire and for us, it's his desire to help us
fulfill
who we are as people, or as a being, maybe. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that's the whole idea of Chava with Adam. Like, in order for Adam to fulfill his purpose, he needs Chava. So Chava's desire to be part of that to fulfill his purpose. Thank you. I'm not sure how to get there with the Yitzhahara and all, but
we're gonna get there. We're gonna get there. Okay, great. This is great. I've got such good. I'm very pleased. I'm happy about all of our participants today because everyone's coming out with really good ideas, which is good. So we're going to talk about male and female desire as understood by Rabbi David Foreman in Source 5. And do I have readers or people who would like to read? If not, I'll read if you don't want to. But other, if there are readers, I want to give them the chance. You want to read? Okay, you read Source 5.
Okay. There are four primal tshukas in the world, say the sages. There are four beings full of life force, seeking to overflow and share that gift of life with others. One of these beings is God. It should come as no surprise that a perfect being would experience rather intensely the desire we call tshuka. The Almighty loves not because he is needy, but because he is full. He wants to share that fullness with others, and to that end he created a world. Another being possessed of life force is rain. The land is parched. Without rain, the land needs rain. But it is rain that experiences the shuka for land. Rain wants to give land what it can. Rain becomes meaningful because of its ability to nourish and to share itself with land. Without land, rain is frustrated, restless. The desire of rain to give life to land is intense. Another great tshuka in the world, say the sages, is the desire of the feminine for the masculine. What is the nature of this desire? To be sure, both men and women desire one another, but they do so for different reasons. Let's talk about men. In traditional Jewish marriage, a man gives a ring to a woman, not the other way around. The reason is that a biblical verse, Deuteronomy 22, verse 15, describes the man as the active partner who takes a woman as his wife. Now, this might strike some as sexist, but I don't think the ancient sages made it that way. Long ago, the sages of the Talmud wondered about this verse in Deuteronomy. Why, they asked, does the Torah state, when a man shall take a woman, why is he, not she, cast as the active partner in marriage and courtship? No, we turned it there. Except I can't get there.
Yeah, there.
Here is their answer. It is comparable to a person who lost something. Who goes searching after whom? I would say the person who lost something searches after that which they lost. The sages are alluding to something in this cryptic statement. Remember the verse in Deuteronomy talks about a man taking a woman? If you search Genesis for some of the very first occurrences of the word take in the Bible, you will come across the following verse. And the Lord took one of Adam's ribs, closed up his skin, and built a rib, and he had taken a man into a woman. When a man takes a woman in marriage, what he is really doing is taking back his lost rib. The person experiencing a loss is the one who searches for what has been lost. The masculine desires the feminine because a man understands on some basic level that he is missing his lost feminine side and he is seeking to reunite with her. The feminine desires the masculine for other reasons. The feminine does not have imprinted on her soul the sense that she is missing something without a man. Since woman was created as a whole being, she does not experience the same masculine sense of lack within herself. Instead, the feminine desires the masculine out of Teshuka. The feminine, like rain and like God, embodies a mysterious life force, and she seeks to give that gift to the masculine.
So this is a really interesting and novel way of looking at Teshuka and at looking at the similarities across the board of Teshuka. So you had asked about evil inclination and Kayin. Rabbi Forman goes on to develop this in the book, and he says a lot of times we misunderstand Yetzer Hara because we often pitch it as this battle of the two sides, but there is this idea of Yetzer Hara as being a tavlin, it's the spice. And so he gives examples where really what it is it's passions. And so they were saying, let's say there was no Yetzer Hara at all in the world, people wouldn't wake up in the morning, they wouldn't build, they wouldn't construct, there would be no passion to do anything. So having that passion, the question is, how does it get channeled? You know, does it get channeled for good and for productivity and creation, or does it get channeled in destructive and negative ways? So similar to the other tissue coat that are listed here, you know, humanity and God, where God wants to give to humanity, or where rain wants to give to the land, or he's saying the woman wants to give to the man, so too, on some interesting deeper level, the evil inclination also wants to give, you know, it wants to give you the passion, the drive to do something, and you have to be the one to control to make sure that it doesn't overpower you to take you to a place where it's only negative. So going back to our original thing where we were talking about Wonder Woman, the question is, you know, what are men necessary for? She claims they're not so necessary, right? You only need them for reproduction. So I said somewhat a Jewish concept, and here's what I mean by that. The man, at least according to Rabbi Forman, is not necessary to the woman in that same intrinsic way that the woman is necessary to the man, right? Because he explains that the man lost something. He lost that part of his body, he lost the rib, and he went searching, and he goes searching for that lost piece of himself. The woman is not in the same place, right? She's not coming to the man because she needs him, because she's lacking. She's coming to the man out of a desire to be a helpmate to him or something like that. So it's not exactly parallel, but I thought it was an interesting idea in terms of the necessary. Yeah?
But isn't the mitzvah on the man of Peru and not of the woman?
You're right. Yeah.
So the woman doesn't have to do it. It's the guy who's got it.
Yeah, so and that yeah, so yeah, you're right. The actual thing.
They don't need you. Yeah. Out of wanting to help him, she's willing to do this, but it's not.
Yeah, but she doesn't really need him. So yes, and we can agree with Diana and Wonder Woman on some level. Yes. So now we get to another scene in the film. We're on number 6, No Man's Land. And this has been a really talked about scene. Here's what happens. I'm going to play it out, right? Steve says, "This is no man's land, Diana. It means no man can cross it, all right? This battalion has been here for nearly a year and they've barely gained an inch, all right? Because on the other side, there are a bunch of Germans pointing machine guns at every square inch of this place. This is not something you can cross. It's not possible." So what? So we do nothing? No, we are doing something. We can't save everyone in this war. This is not what we came here to do. No, but it's what I'm going to do. Diana! Right? And then it becomes apparent that she's taking all of the fire, so all the men come scrambling after her to attack in her wake. So it's this very powerful scene where, you know, the woman is the leader, she's the one who's going out, and the men are kind of following in her wake. So this has been talked about, and people are like, oh, only in 2017 have we progressed enough that we could get to this stage. And what's interesting is that, not so. We actually have a very similar encounter back in our Tanakh. Before I tell it to you, does anyone want to guess where we have a woman leader, we have a man? Okay, perfect. So you've already got it. So if you flip on over to number 7, right, source 7, we have this nice story. There was, in the time of the judges, we had these people, Devorah and Barak. And it's unclear exactly what their connection is. Most Midrashim say that they're actually married, and that Barak and Lapidot, because it says she's Eshet Lapidot, are the same. And so there's a relationship between the two. But what we have happening is, right, Vatishlach Vatikra LeBarak Ben Avinoam, she summons Barak, the son of Avinoam, and she tells him, right, Halotziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Lechu Mashachta Bahar Tavor, V'lakachta Imcha Aseret Alafim, Ish Mimnei Naphtali, Mimnei Zevulun, Mashachti Elecha El Nachal Kishon, Et Sisra, Sarzva Yavin, Vias Richpo, Vias Hamono, right, go march on Mount Tavor, take with you 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zevulun, I'm going to draw Sisra, who's the army commander there, and I'll deliver him into your hands. Right, so she's informing him of the plan. Here is the battle plan. I've gotten the plan from God. You know, this is some kind of prophecy. This is her as a prophetess informing him what needs to get done. And interestingly, right, Barak's response to that, if you look at 8, right, but Barak said to her, Im telchi imi v'halachti, v'im lo telchi imi lo elech. Right, if you're going to go with me, I'll go, and if not, I will not go. So he's afraid, at least according to the pshat, meaning the commentaries have a field day, there's a lot of different interpretations, but plain pshat, he is afraid to go into battle without Devorah, either at his side spiritually or at his side literally. So she says to him, okay, because you are scared, I will go with you, but I want you to know you're going to lose the glory, right? It was supposed to be this glory and very exciting situation where you as the man, Barak, were going to ride out and you were going to vanquish Sisera and it was all going to be this fantastic victory for you. Now it's going to happen differently. It's going to be a woman who vanquishes Sisera. And who is that woman? Is anyone familiar? Yael, perfect, right? And so what's interesting is also there's a lot that's made of the fact that how Yael does it, she does it as a woman. Like she's not, you know, this warrior going out into battle. She's a woman in her tent who draws Sisera in and says, oh, I'll give you a drink. You can come lay down here. There's a not PG version of what she does with him in the tent as well, right? But right, and then she kills him with a tent peg. And what's interesting is that's actually, there's a similar scene in the movie where Diana has to dress for this gala, and she's dressed in this like fancy, beautiful dress, and she ends up meeting the guy that she thinks is Ares. She ends up being mistaken about it, but she thinks it's him, and he's very attracted to her, and so she kind of has a moment where maybe she could kill him right then, but Steve stops her because Steve thinks that that's not the way to go about it. So you have it's an interesting balance between seeing her as this fierce Amazonian and also seeing her even within her female, more traditional role, still being able to seduce or to, you know, interact with that general. So point being, you didn't have to wait till 2017 to find this. We had it before. It was in our tradition. Okay, now we get to source number 8. So finally, she has discovered the god of war. She's interacting with Ares. She first kills this other general, General Ludendorff, and she's shocked when nothing happens, and she realizes, oh, I made a mistake. That wasn't really Ares. But here's the real Ares. So this is my mission in life. This is why I've been raised on this island. I'm supposed to kill this man, and then everything will go back to being good because he's the reason for why men are evil. You know, it's almost like killing as it were, like, you know, a Yetzer Hara or a Satan figure, and like thinking that, oh, that will all go away. So that's what she believes. And Ares says some disturbing things to her. He says, I am not your enemy, Diana. I'm the only one who truly knows you and who truly knows them. And he's talking about humans and humanity, as you now do. Humans don't deserve our help. They only deserve destruction. And there's this woman, this Dr. Poison, who I had mentioned before. So he's saying to her, destroy her, Diana. You know she deserves it. They all do. So Diana has a struggle now. She's being tested. On the one hand, she realizes that what he says is true. She's seen at this point in the film enough evidence that there's humans who act not only because there's an evil god whispering in their ear, but just out of their own personal self-interest, desire for power, things like that. And that's very disappointing to her because that's not the way she was raised on her island. And now we have a clash between her idealistic views and the reality that she's facing. And she agrees. She feels like, you know, humanity doesn't deserve to be saved, doesn't deserve my help because they're wicked from the core, which we have an idea that's similar by us too, that, you know, you have Yetzer Hara from the time you're young. Okay, so Ares is trying to get her to destroy these humans. And she says, they're everything you say, but so much more. You're wrong about them. And Ares counters, they don't deserve your protection. And she counters, it's not about what you deserve, it's about what you believe, and I believe in love. So this scene is actually, there's a parallel scene in our tradition. Not with a woman, with a man. Does anyone know who it is? Abraham, you think? What did you say? David and Jonathan? Okay, so talk to me about that. I didn't think of that parallel. Do you want to tell me in what way? No? Okay. All right. So, okay, yeah. So I guess the fact that Jonathan, you know, gives up his throne for David, and in reality they could be enemies, but they're not. So the scene that I was looking at actually has to do with Moshe. Oh, you had an idea? I'm sorry.
Why does God continue with the Jewish people even though they continuously reject him?
Yes, and so probably one of the most famous scenes happened right after they've created this golden calf. So what happened is God had given them tablets, and it was supposed to be almost like a marriage proposal, and like the equivalent of a ketubah. You know, here are your marriage documents, here are the tablets. And instead, what they're doing is they create this golden calf, and they're all dancing around it, and they're worshiping, and so on. And Moshe's up on the mountain, and Hashem says to him, and this is source number 9, right? I see that this is an Am Kishei Oref, a stiff-necked people. Let me be that my anger may blaze forth against them, and that I may destroy them and make of you a great nation. So the very deal that Ares is offering Diana, the deal is, let's destroy all the humans, and you and I will be the partner gods, right? You know, Diana and Ares, we'll start over the world, and it will be our world. We'll take it back. We'll make it good. And so that's actually the same deal on some level God's offering Moshe, right? God says to Moshe, you know what? They're sinners. They're stubborn. They're unsalvageable. We can't fix it. So I'm going to kill them all. I'll kill out all of Bnei Israel. We'll start afresh with you, Moshe. Moshe and his wife, you know, you can propagate. We can have a new humanity. And what's interesting is that Diana's response to this challenge is she says, humanity doesn't deserve to be saved, right? It's not about deserving, but it's about belief, and I believe in love, and I believe pretty much that they have the ability to make the right choices eventually down the line. And what's interesting is if you look at Moshe's arguments here, Moshe argues kind of similarly because he doesn't say that Bnei Israel deserve it. He doesn't start arguing with Hashem, oh, but they're really good people and they're going to make good choices. Instead, he goes on this argument that at first seems really odd in Pasuk 12. Don't let the Egyptians say that God took Bnei Israel out of Egypt only to kill them off in the mountains, because then they're going to doubt your power. Right? Oh, he was able to take them out with all those miracles from Egypt, but then he just murdered them in the desert, so he wasn't really so powerful. The other argument that that Moshe brings in number 13 is the promise that God had made to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Right? So it's not about deserving here either. Right? He's not arguing, oh, they deserve to be saved. He's arguing instead, there are two other issues. How you'll be perceived by the nations, which is concerning, because part of what you're trying to do is bring monotheism to the world and show that you are God and you are powerful, and they're not going to perceive you that way if you kill out the whole nation now. And also, you made a promise not to them, but to their forefathers who were more deserving than them. So in both situations, you've got a character, you know, the superhero, whether it's Wonder Woman, whether it's Moshe, who has an opportunity to start over fresh, just Ares and Diana, or just Moshe and his family. And in both situations, they turn it down. They're like, nope, we're not doing it. Not about deserving, but it's about believing on some level that these people should carry on. Then we get to a scene which is probably where we most deviate in Jewish tradition from the movie. This Dr. Poison. Ares wants Diana, Wonder Woman, to kill Dr. Poison. And his thought is she deserves it, and in killing Dr. Poison, that would set Diana up to go kill all humans. She would like be able to make in her mind a decision the same way this woman is evil and she creates this horrible poison and gas. So too, the rest of humanity has that potential for evil within them. So in most superhero movies, for those of you who are familiar with Batman and others, right, the one code that they're not supposed to cross, they're never supposed to kill. It's very rare that the superhero is allowed to kill. So she has this big struggle, you know, should I kill the poison woman? Should I not kill the poison woman? And she decides not to kill her. She lets her go. She lets her escape. And this is a woman who's responsible for thousands of people being dead. So, is that a Jewish concept? Do we show mercy to people who killed thousands of other people? No, we don't. So that's one of the biggest distinctions, if we're analyzing the film, of where we go differently from Wonder Woman's choices. And I have a couple of examples for you of how we know that that's not a Jewish concept. And the first is in Shemot, Exodus, and source 11. And now we're going back to having readers if anyone wants to read. So we're on page 6 and source 11. Go ahead.
When a man schemes against another and kills him treacherously, you shall take him from my very altar to put to death.
Okay. So this week's past Parsha was actually all about Arei Miklat, cities of refuge. And for those of you who are in Shul, you've heard about it. And for those of you who weren't, in very short, there were certain places where if someone killed accidentally, it was an accidental murder, there was this idea that there was someone called a Goel Hadam who could go and have a blood payment, like they could kill that person. But if the person ran to the city of refuge, then there would be a trial, and it would be determined if it had truly been an accident, that person could remain in the city of refuge, which was a place of sanctuary, until such time that the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, died. But it's different if it was deliberate murder. And the source for why it's different comes from here in Shmot, where it says that if you have someone scheming against another who's killing him treacherously, this is not an accident, this is not a shogeg, this is someone who deliberately planned it, you can take him from my very altar to die. Meaning there is no sanctuary that protects such a person. This is not a person who can run to the city of refuge and be protected there, because that person schemed and did it deliberately. And in the case that we're discussing in the film with Dr. Poison, she's very deliberately, as a chemist, concocting all these poisons and coming up with ways to unleash them upon the world. Right? This is not accidental. And so if you look at number 12, this is the Rambam from the Mora Nevuchim, Guide for the Perplexed. And he elaborates upon this idea that if you go down a little bit for where it says, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. So that's where we'll begin. Thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. Do I have any readers for number 12? Any of you want to read? Okay, go ahead.
Thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. Here a person comes to seek the help of Hashem and claims the protection of that which is devoted to his name. Hashem, however, does not help him and commands that he be delivered up to the prosecutor from whom he fled. Much less need any one of us help or pity his fellow man under such circumstances. Because mercy on sinners is cruelty to all creatures. These are undoubtedly the right ways designated, righteous statutes and judgments, Devarim 4:8, and different from the ways of the fools who consider a person praiseworthy when he helps and protects his fellow man without discriminating between the oppressor and the oppressed. This is well known from their words in Psalms.
So Rambam would have a lot to say about this scene in Wonder Woman, where she decides to let this poisoner go. You know, he would say, you're not discriminating between the oppressor and the oppressed, right? You're saying, oh, it's very important to have mercy on humanity, and I'm going to be merciful to this doctor. Don't be merciful to her. She killed tons of people, and she's not remorseful. She just doesn't want to die now that she's stuck between these two gods, Ares and Wonder Woman, who are fighting. So he would not be a fan, right? This scene in the movie, Rambam would be like, nope, we're going to nope right out of here. Similarly, you might have seen another example of this in a famous story about King Saul, who spared King Agag, who was one of the Amalekites. And there's a concept which comes down in source number 13, that one who is compassionate to the cruel will ultimately become cruel to the compassionate. What happened was that when it came to the Amalekites, Saul was made some decisions to spare certain members of the Amalek nation. But later on, when it came to the city of Kohanim, the city of Nob, he killed them all. Now, whether or not, you know, Diana is destined to go down that path, now that she's been merciful to the compassionate, you know, we hope not. We hope she'll stay good. Merciful to the wicked is what I meant to say. We hope she'll stay good. But that's an idea that's in our tradition, that this is not something we should do. All right, flipping on over to number 14, we have this very stark and clear representation of Yetzer Hara versus Yetzer Tov in what she says. This is towards the end of the film. She says, I used to want to save the world, to end war and bring peace to mankind. But then I glimpsed the darkness that lives within their light. I learned that inside every one of them, there will always be both. The choice each must make for themselves, something no hero will ever defeat. I've touched the darkness that lives in between the light, seen the worst of this world and the best, seen the terrible things men do to each other in the name of hatred and the lengths they'll go to for love. Now I know only love can save this world, so I stay. I fight and I give for the world I know can be. This is my mission now, forever. So I just thought that was very nicely put within a completely secular film articulation of part of something that we believe on a very fundamental level. Every single human is engaged in that struggle between Yetzer Hara and Yetzer Tov, right? Every single person has to make that choice every day about the light and the dark and everything she's articulating here. So that's, again, very Jewish concept and right here in our superhero film. Lastly, right, source number 15, the overall approach to Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman as a heroine and as a superhero is actually super unique. And this is an article that was published in The Culture Trip that explains why. Right, so Wonder Woman was originally designed to draw strength from empathy and love. To her great credit, Jenkins, this is the director of the film, doesn't shy away from these stereotypically feminine attributes, but makes them the basis of Diana's power. She doesn't run on primeval adrenaline, but rather deep compassion. Too often, we see superheroes engage in combat because, well, that's what they're supposed to do. Here, there's a true and meaningful connection between cause and effect. Diana is shocked, for example, when Steve encourages their hastily assembled team to rush past a devastated village on the way to the front lines. Steve is saddened by the sight of starving families being preyed on by mercenaries, but the priority is to reach Ludendorff as quickly as possible, and Steve won't deviate from the plan secretly approved by his superior. Diana can't follow him. Benevolence is the force that drives her. She sees suffering, and she has to alleviate it. Don't get the wrong idea, though. While Amazons don't like violence, they're more than willing to use it, and it seems in flashy, fiery style. So especially today, right, 2017, there's been so much discussion about gender roles, whether that's gender roles in terms of Judaism, whether that's gender roles in terms of anything else in our world. We have this book, Lean In, by Sheryl Sandberg. All of us are, not all of us, but many of us are trying to juggle career and life and the balance and family and so on. And there's a lot of discussion of what should a woman be? What is a woman? What makes a woman, you know? And sometimes when we read the texts, especially the Jewish texts, which seem to privilege what others see as more traditional views of women, women as more merciful or more nurturing or more loving, you know, gets a bad rap. It's like, no, you know, we should be strong and powerful and so on. And one of the things that I think is really the most Jewish thing about this film is that the entire superhero, the nature of Wonder Woman, is that it's predicated upon ideas that within our Jewish tradition are considered to be essential to what a female is, and that part of being female is being loving or being nurturing or having benevolence and having compassion for others. And she's not killing others out of a desire to, like, one-up them or murder for the sake of justice. She's killing to protect. Her concern all throughout the film is there are women and children dying here. We need to protect them. We need to save the people. So that's very unique. And I've watched a lot of superhero films, and this is one of the first times I can remember seeing a superhero who's acting out of kindness and empathy with others, as opposed to, you know, in a lot of other films, if you think about Batman, for example, you know, his parents got killed by criminals, so he's going to make a war on crime. You know, it's a revenge situation. This is not revenge, not at all. And so last piece, if you, the very word rechem, rechem means womb, right? So it says the womb is the paradigm of this concept of caring for another's totally dependent needs. In metaphysical terms, compassion is a similarly deep commitment to feeling the other's reality, identifying their specific needs, taking action to assist, and it starts with being motivated to care and reaching the point where you feel the other's pain. So, you know, whether or not someone is actually a, you know, a mother biologically, adoption, whatever, but just this idea that rechem and rachamim are connected, that this is an essential quality of being a woman who's born female, that this is, these things are linked, again, that fits very nicely with who Wonder Woman is as a character, as she was developed, the way she plays out in the film. And then we have this piece by Rabbi Kalonymus Kalman Shapira, also known as the Piatzetzner Rebbe, where he talks about the, in his opinion, that the reason women and children are more compassionate, I'm all the way on the bottom, the part that's bolded, toward others, more so than adult men, this is his view, they basically have someone who cares and provides for them, a husband for his wife, parents for their children. Not feeling abandoned in this world, they have no need to build a protective shield around the self, and because their sense of selfness has not been blown out of proportion, they are more able to see through to the predicament of others and to have compassion for them. Now, certainly things have changed since he wrote that, in that now you might have the woman who's caring for the man or providing for the man, things like that. It's a little bit more equal in terms of how, who is earning money and who's doing the work. But what I thought was so interesting is his view that people who grow up with others around them who care for them or who protect them are more able then to pass that forward. And that is something that is, again, very much shown in this film. Because Diana is raised on this island of the Amazons, which is surrounded, it's only women, and all of the women care for one another, and there's a lot of showing the depth of their care. She has this aunt, Antiope, who trains her really hard so that she'll succeed. And in fact, when this happens, where the Germans come in, that aunt gives her life to protect Diana. So her whole life, she's seen and been part of this community of people who are caring and loving towards her, and therefore when she goes out into the world, she's able to take those concepts and pass them forward and be this nurturing, empathetic person. In contrast to which, you've got Steve, and Steve is a guy who, for most of his life, has to live by his wits. There's no one looking out for him, so he's got to look out for himself. And that's why Steve, as a character in the film, is much less compelled by the need to nurture or to be empathetic towards others, because he hasn't had it himself. So I was thinking one takeaway for everybody is that in whatever role you play, you know, and some people here are going to be moms, you know, biological moms, and some people here are going to be someone's adoptive mom or grandma or whatever it may be, that's something that we can very easily do. You know, when we show care and love and protection and nurturing to others, whether it's in a role as a parent or as a friend, when people feel that, then they're much more able to pass that on and bring that to others. And that's the strength that Wonder Woman was given by her community, and which enables her to be that nurturing, empathic person who can do those heroic, flashy things and kill the bad guys, but who does it coming out of love and not coming out of a desire for revenge.
Very well.
Okay.